Okay, I'm going to try that again.
People will wake up when they
yeah. Okay, so the first question we tried to deal with is the nature of the of the Isaribis. I think this part of the fire alarm we can deal with. Now that question really divides, and this is really important. I mean, to one, what is the motivation, the tam hamitzvah, the philosophy behind the mitzvah of ribis? And the second question we'd have to ask is not what motivated it, but whatever motivated it, what is the nature of the prohibition from a legal perspective? They aren't necessarily the same question. I mean, you could say that what motivates, as we'll see in a moment, ribis is some sort of tzedakah-esque obligation, and say that once the Torah said that because of tzedakah you aren't allowed to charge interest, if you do charge interest, it is theft because you're not entitled to that money, right? Or you could say, no, that it remains not theft, it remains something else. So those are really two distinct questions. The first question we dealt with is what is the motivation, right? What is the tam hamitzvah, the philosophy for the Issur Ribis? And here we had, why is this still going on? We had basically three possibilities. But they divided into two main categories, right? The first way of understanding this Aribis, and this is how it appears at least in two of the contexts in Chumash, is that it's a function of the mitzvah of tzedakah, that just like you have to give people money when they need it, so you also have to extend free loans to people when they need it. Now, the problem you'd have to ask sort of from a philosophical perspective is, okay, if it is, the question we have to ask is, okay, well, if ribis is about, is tzedakah, and that's the context, right, that when someone's poor and he needs a loan, so he comes to you and you offer him a loan and you shouldn't charge interest, then you have to ask the question, okay, well then, why is it that the Isser of Ribis applies not just when you're lending money to a poor person, but even if you're lending money to a rich person? So here, you have two possibilities. One is to say that it's just the way the Torah works. The Torah works in lo plugs, right? The Torah works in, that's just law, as the Rambam notes in the Mor Nebuchim. Law is law. It's universal. It doesn't love exceptions, and as few exceptions as we can have. But fundamentally, the mitzvah is really, at its core, about helping the poor. The other possibility, as noted by Shmuel Abuav, is that maybe we just have to expand what we think the word poor means. I mean, in the context of tzedakah, sure, poor means someone who doesn't have enough food for X number of days, X number of meals, the Gemara goes through it. Maybe in this case, it just means anyone who, at the moment, has a need is clearly poorer than he needs to be. He's ani lo tov davar, right? If he needs to enter into this business deal, he doesn't have the capital, and he takes out a loan for it, so he's poor for that purpose. So it's a more expansive notion of tzedakah. It's not, you know, tzedakah. You don't have to give a free gift to someone who's wealthy but doesn't have enough money for an investment. You don't have to give it for free, but you should give him without interest. Now, I noted that while this is, you know, fundamentally a philosophical question, it has real implications, and many of the poskim following this train of thought, that ribis, the prohibition against ribis, is a function of our commitment to charity, our commitment to giving money to those who need it without, taking advantage of them. Many poskim, therefore, opposed heter iska in a case when you're lending money to either a poor person or even an average person who needs money. So Chaim David HaLevi, for example, says, yeah, ribis is about tzedakah. So look, it's true that as a formality, ribis applies even when you're lending to a wealthy person. But the tam hamitzvah isn't violated. And as an ethical statement, he thinks it's legitimate to use haramo, to use halachic loopholes when all you're contending with is the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law doesn't apply. And therefore, Chaim David HaLevi says he doesn't think that there's any problem using a heter iska, for example, when you're taking a you know, getting a bond, for example, right, from the country without any other potential problem. He said, look, you're lending money to the big guy, right? You're lending, you're taking a bank bond, you're taking government bond. In that case, he says, it's ethical to use a hetereska because ribis is about the big guy protecting the small guy, not the small guy protecting the big guy. And therefore, he thinks, and from an ethical perspective, he would endorse the hetereska. When you're taking out a, you know, a bond or something like that, he wouldn't endorse the hetereska from a Torah ethical perspective if you're lending to a poor person or even to an average person who needs capital for an investment, because that goes against the spirit of the law. The problem we noted here is that if it's really about tzedakah and purely about tzedakah, so then it makes sense that there's a prohibition for the malveh. But ribis uniquely has a prohibition, not just a lifnei iver, but an actual prohibition, the araisa, for the lender to take the money, the borrower to take the money, biribis, which is a bit weird if it's stuck. And this is why many of the mafarshim divide. Either they say this is lifnei iver-esque, it's not actually lifnei iver, but it's lifnei iver-esque, or it's a siag. And the way they formulate it is that perhaps because lending with interest is so common, we have to set up extra safeguards for your own benefit, right? For the benefit of the poor. Well, you can sit here. But, okay. The second possible sort of motivation is that it's not about staka, and this is derives from a different focus. That if you look in the psukim, in some places it focuses on the staka component, and it's in the context of staka. But the other focus in these psukim is that you are allowed, or maybe even obligated, to lend to non-Jews with ribis. So others suggest that no, the logic of ribis isn't, the provision of ribis isn't staka, isn't that you're extending charity. It's that if your actual brother came to you and said, look, I really need money to put food on the table, you wouldn't lend with interest. The reason there's a prohibition of ribis is because you're obligated to treat Jews as family, and therefore there's nothing wrong with lending with interest. It just shows a lack of intimacy between you, and this is a violation. Now, the Mefarshim divide on whether the problem is simply interpersonal, that you're supposed to treat Jews as family, or that as Jews you're supposed to recognize that your parnasa comes from God, and therefore it's really a ben adam lamakom problem. It's a emuna problem. But of course and that's why I put those together. Because the common denominator, even though one is ben adam lamakom, one is ben adam chaveiro, is that the problem isn't about me being obligated to help that person as much as a function of the recognition of how we have to, right, act either towards each other, not because I'm helping him, not helping him, just because it's a recognition of our relationship, either our relationship to each other as equals or a relationship together to God. But it's not about me helping him, it's about our, right, the nafka mina to that is that, as Rav Yoel ben Nun notes, on an ethical halachic level, back to the hetereska issue, there might be a real difference between whether you are dealing with a bank or you're dealing with an individual. Like, even leaving aside, Rav Moshe Feinstein formally thinks that there's no ribis when the bank is borrowing money because they have no person, no single person is liable, right? It's the assets of the corporation that's liable. Yoel ben Nun says, forget the halachic.
Even if the Jewish bank in Israel.
Correct, because he says, since they don't have personal liability, he thinks there's no ribis problem. Rav Yoel ben Nun says, leave aside that question. Right? Leave aside the formal question, do you think that a corporation halachically is a separate entity or not? He said, from a ethical perspective, the fact is that, yes, when you relate to a bank, you're relating to it as an entity. It's not, there's not a person that is, you're now borrowing from biribis. It's an entity, and there is, at least, right? So this is not saying you don't need a hetereska. It's a question of when is it ethical to use that hetereska. So, well, in that corporate context where there already is that lack of intimacy, there is no, right, who is your brother, right? And Rav Yaakov Ariel didn't like this, not because of formal reasons. He entitles his response, or at least the section in his response about this, Habankim achicha ata, right? Or achinu ata, something, whatever it is. Achiata, something along those lines, right? The banks, you are a brother. That, no, if you really think that corporations are made up of individuals, so then on an ethical perspective, you can't hide from the fact there are individuals behind this this legal fiction. But that whole discourse comes from this type of understanding. So that was the first question, right? What is the motivation of the mitzvah? The second question, which is related to this, but it's distinct, is, okay, well, what is the nature of the prohibition? So as I said, right, you could say that the motivation of the mitzvah is tzedaka, but once God said, you're not allowed to lend with interest, if you do, it turns into gezel, right? So the question of the motivation and then the resulting nature of the prohibition aren't identical. They could be. I mean, we noted the Rishonim and Achronim really divide into three ways, and it all comes down to the sugya at the beginning of the perek. At the beginning of the perek, the Gemara said, why is it that you need the prohibition of ribis, onah, and gzela? Aren't they the same thing? Aren't they all forms of gzela? So then the Gemara gives all types of explanations. There's two ways of reading the Gemara. One is to say that these are all three forms of theft. It's just that they're not identical, and therefore the Torah had to tell you that this was theft. Right? Ribbis isn't obvious because he did it willingly. But once the Torah told you, the result is that it is theft. Alternatively, the Gemara is telling you, no, it's actually not theft. Right? Like, when you lend with interest, you're not supposed to do it, but the result is not that you stole from the person, it's that you were mevatel some other mitzvah. What would that other mitzvah be? So I think two possibilities lend themselves. One is that it's, as we've noted, a violation of tzedaka. Right, that it's a bitul mitzvah of tzedakah, and that's really what Chidah says. And the I tried to, because it's a summary share, just pick out sort of the main points. The Chidah was the most striking, right? The Chidah says that when you lend somebody, when you give somebody tzedakah, you should have in mind that you are also being the Mekai, you're also being, it's the other way around. When you lend money without interest, you should have in mind that you are also being Mekayim the mitzvah of tzedakah. Other Acharnim we noted say, no, it's not a function of the mitzvah of tzedakah, it's a function of the mitzvah of lending money, right? You're obligated to lend money, and one of the subsections of that is you're not supposed to lend it with interest. If you do, you're being mevatel the mitzvah, so say, of lending money to other people. And we noted that there are many different implications to this, some on a conceptual level, such as, and I didn't give them, you know, I gave you some of them here. So, right, the nature of the return, the obligation to return the money, right? Is it a subsection of Chiyuv Gzela, and the Rambam, for example, doesn't quote a Chiyuv to give back Ribbis, and therefore many of the Acharnim say, yeah, because he thinks it's just a Chiyuv of returning Gezel, or is it, right, a unique Chiyuv and it needs its own Pasuk? We saw that there's a Machlokes about whether, after the guy's already paid Ribbis, the money's already in his hands, is he allowed to be Mochel on it, right? Is he allowed to say, look, I understand, I should, you know, I understand that this was all wrong, but, you know, just keep it at this point. So the Rambam says, yeah, at that point, you're allowed to say keep it, because, you know, in the end of the day, any monetary, you know, obligation, even if I steal from you, I wasn't allowed to steal from you, but if I steal from you and then you say, you know what, you weren't supposed to steal, you're supposed to give it back to me, but I don't care, just keep it, you're allowed to do that. If it's gezel, so I'm allowed to post facto say keep it. The Gaonim, though, hold, you're not allowed to. That even if the money's already in his hands and he said, look, here's the money, you aren't allowed to say, keep it. You have to give it back because it's, you know, it's not zela, right? There's a non-monetary component here. There's a mitzvah component that is actually more powerful than the monetary component, and therefore you do have to. It could be, though it's not at all obvious, the subject of the machlokas in the Gemara itself, of whether ribbis ktut says yotze b'dayanim, of whether the courts can force you to pay back ribbis. You know, if it's gzela, then obviously they can. If it's not gzela, maybe you're not supposed to do it, but once you've done it, we can't force you to give it back. That's not obvious for a million reasons, but it might be part of that discussion. Yeah?
Biblically, are you allowed to steal from a goy?
No.
Okay. So, it says, lanachri tashich.
So again, as I noted, saying it's gzela doesn't mean that it's gzela in a vacuum. It's a gzela only because gzela means taking money that I shouldn't have. if the Torah said that you're not allowed to lend beribis to someone, so then once I did it, it might be gezel. It doesn't, and that was why I was careful to distinguish between motivation and result. Right? You can say that the motivation isn't that it's gzela. It's not wrong to lend with interest in a vacuum. It's just the Torah said don't. Once the Torah said don't and you did it, it may be that that money is considered stolen money. That doesn't mean that the act of taking ribis, absent the Torah telling it to you, is theft, right? That's why we have to be very careful distinguishing between the motivation and the result, right? You can have something that, no, it's not really wrong. It's not theft. It's just once the Torah said you aren't allowed to take this money, if you keep it, then it's gzela. You're right, and Tosfos brings this up, that it is explicit in the Torah that you're allowed to lend to a non-Jew with ribbon.
The Torah says almost you should.
Right. That's
more than that.
Correct. That's explicit. But Tosfos raises the question, maybe that's only true between a Jew and a non-Jew, but non-Jew to non-Jew and Jew to Jew, right, both have prohibitions. The only time there isn't a prohibition is from Jew to non-Jew or non-Jew to Jew. So it is possible that this is a gzela, which is, you know, sort of intra-tribal or something, right? Relating to non-Jews as one big tribe, which is interesting, but whatever. It's possible, right, that it really is gezel in that sense, and then there's some weird, you know, gzeres hakasuv that accepts the Jew to non-Jew category. But the simplest understanding is not like Tosfos, is that the motivation is not gzela, right? Usury might be, you know, gzela, where it's, you know, really obsessive, but, you know, or excessive rather. But I mean, I think in the States, the number is like 60% for considered excessive. So, what?
Here also,
I think it's about 59%.
Yeah. Okay. But I didn't put in the outline because I only heard it last night. But apparently the Muslim law, Sharia law, is even more extreme than Jewish law, and therefore they also have come up with their own haramot. And in fact, they came up with Rabbi Bleich's suggestion for real estate, where they, you know, instead of using a hederiska, they do an extended lease. You know,
lease with acquisition of equity.
Exactly. The Muslim scholars, though, opposed it because they noted that after all was said and done, the bank was giving the person every year a statement that he then used for a tax return. That because in the States you get a tax write off for interest that you pay in your house, and the bank was giving him something and said, yeah, this is how much interest you paid that year, and he got a tax write off for it. So they, just like Jews have a problem with haramot, the Sharia scholars also have similar ethical problems. And what? Exactly. And so I was listening to a share by Jake Lewin, where he actually said he had a court case like this, where someone set it up like this, and it was rejected. He was told by like a senior lawyer, don't even bother bringing it to court, they will count that as usury, and they will reject that contract because it's more than 60%.
Mm-hmm.
It was like mugzam, like, anyway. But this, you know, this sort of struggling with the letter of the law, the haramot, and trying to find something that is not obviously, you know, against the spirit and maybe even letter of the law, is not unique to Jews. It's anybody with any anti-ribbis laws, which in this case is Jews and Muslims. Okay, that's end sort of bracket here. The next question we dealt with in terms of the nature of ribbis, right? So we've dealt with now with two main questions. One is the motivation, and two is what is the resulting prohibition. The third question is, what is the difference between neshech and tarbit? So the Gemara notes that that mid d'oraisa, you need both neshech and tarbit. What is neshech and tarbit? So neshech is that the borrower needs to lose, and tarbit is that the lender needs to gain. The Gemara notes that there is no case on a biblical level where you can have one without the other. If you have one without the other, then it is derabanan, right? Despite that, the Achronim are totally convinced that there are cases, and they go to great lengths of trying to find cases, like things which are usur behana'a, but aren't niharg valyavor, and the borrower is and is allowed to eat it, but the lender isn't. Or they come up with all those very clever cases, but fundamentally, the Gemara says there is no such case. But the conceptual distinction does exist, and that's why the Derabbanans really do play on this, right? The Derabbanans really do. Some of the Derabbanans are tarbit without neshech. So, for example, ribbis dvarim, if you assume it's darabanan, is essentially tarbit without neshech, right? Or even less. But clearly, the lender isn't, the borrower isn't losing anything by greeting, however you understand that greeting. But the lender is gaining. And we've seen that many of the darabanans are playing on either neshech without tarbit or tarbit without neshech, and that all the cases of, right, what happens if you, you know, saw b'sa, and all those different cases are all playing on that fundamental distinction, because as Rosenzweig notes, the fact that the Gemara goes through this discussion at all tells you that even if there's no practical implication on a biblical level, what the Torah is telling you is there are two distinct reasons why ribbis is wrong. One is that you're taking money away from the borrower that he shouldn't lose, and two is that the lender is gaining money for not doing anything, right? For agar natarle, just for giving out money, which isn't legitimate. And that's why you see in the Darabanans them playing on both Neshech and Tarbit, because they really are two conceptual issues that got swallowed up together on the Daraisa, but are in fact fundamentally different Mechaivim.
Another level of no pain, no gain.
Yes. Sort of. The last thing we noted here is that the uniqueness of Ribbis overflows into who is Osir. So we already noted, whatever it is, it's not a normal gzela, right? It's not a normal tzedakah, right? Whatever ribbis is, it's so bad that, you know, the Torah sets up safeguards that don't exist anywhere else. So as the Gemara notes at the end of the perek, not only is it Osir for the malveh, it's Osir for the loveh, it's Osir d'oraisa for the edim, and not just because of lifnei iver, right? There may be a special one. The midrash adds the dayanim, it's Osir for the sirsur. Practically, as Rabbi Reis notes, that means there is a biblical prohibition to be a lawyer for two Jews who are entering into a ribbis contract. That is a sirsur, right? You want to know what a sirsur is. In English, it's the guy who is, right, the lawyer who's actually bringing together the parties, is ensuring, you know.
Technically, the sirsur is the broker.
Right, but as he said, the modern equivalent, who he says is obvious, it's a facilitator. That's really what it is, right? Meaning, he said, Sirsur isn't just facilitator. I was listening to him last night. He said, it's anybody who facilitates. Who is that if not the lawyer? He said, if you are a Jewish, he was talking to lawyers. He said, if you are a lawyer and there are two Jews and they're ending a ribbis thing, you cannot enter in that. You cannot be involved in that. It's an Isser d'oraisa, right? That is this Isser of Sirsur, which I think is right. You know, I think it makes sense. No, is any worse than a broker?
Well, the question is, where do you cross the line from lifnei iver to being a violator of ribbis?
Yeah, I mean, look, if he's helping write up the contract, you know, he is the sofer, right? No, if he's signing the contract, he's the edim, right? If he's involved, he's the sirsur. I think, you know, the lawyer could be one of three people in this monstrosity of, and again, this reflects the uniqueness of the prohibition. We noted that there are different ways of understanding this, right? Whether there's one big Isser with multiple parties or there's multiple Isserim, there are some implications. I'm not going to go back into it. A psule edus, right? There's a machlokas. Exactly who's possible edus in this case, right? Can you have a case, right? The malveh isn't possible edus. What can you have, you know, is it possible that the other people are possible edus? Is it possible that some of these people will get malkos, right? The malveh doesn't get malkos because it's a lav which you can return, because you can pay back, even if that doesn't fully solve the problem. But there is a machlokas in the Rishonim. What about the Lova? What about the Edim? Do they get Malkus? Can they get Malkus if the Malva doesn't? And that relates to the question of, is it really that the main Isser is the Malva and everything else is just a series of Siyagim to prevent the Malva, right? Prevent lenders from lending with interest? Or are these, in fact, distinct Isserim with their own... with their own natures? That was really the first question that we dealt with. And that was, you know, the one I spent
just
like 3 weeks on.
Just on a practical level, I'll tell you, we encounter situations where a Jew is going to lend to another Jew. Neither, sometimes one or neither have any idea about a Heather Iska, and I have to get them to sign it.
And that's a good thing to do. Yeah.
No, but I'm saying sometimes they've never heard of it, okay? Sometimes they don't care or whatever, but it's amazing. They usually do sign.
Wow. Okay, good to know.
There has to be a loan, though, right? Because there has to be a loan. Because in litigation, let's say if you just sue for damages, there's no loan, but you're suing for damages, you will always claim in your claim for pre-judgment and post-judgment interest.
Yeah, I assume in that case it's not Usher, because you haven't been zakif alav the milvah yet, right?
Who is this from?
I mean, you mean from another Jew?
I sue you.
You mean in a secular court, but to another Jew?
Yeah, and for damages, not based on all, but just general damages. Yeah. You always claim pre-judgment and post-judgment interest.
Right. Right. So maybe post-judgment would be problematic, because then you're zakif alav the milvah. Pre is probably not a problem.
I don't know if it's worded as interest. It sounds like it is a problem.
Is it?
Can you have
interest on non-loan? Even if it's called interest.
You definitely can. The question is called derech halva.
That's what I'm saying. Is it derech halva before your zokif alav milva? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I have to look into it. By which I mean I have to email or erase or something. But I'm sure there's a discussion of it in one of these books. I'm sure the Brisikud has a discussion somewhere.
In a lot of times in non-Jewish law, they say this is X, it's not to be considered a penalty. Here, in our law, it would help if considered a penalty.
So that's sort of true, but we also have that. We also have that it shouldn't be considered a penalty, but that's a sugya that we skipped here, which is a smachta. But if you want, I'll send you the
last week we said about...
No, I understand. But the sugyas that we're skipping in the parak, the non-ribbis sugyas, are the flip side, that if it's a smachta problems, are dafka more problematic when it's kanas. I'll send you my share. I gave a share on that dafka last year on non-refundable loans, which is on the sugya in the middle. Not loans, non-refundable deposits, which is that question. It's the weirdest Canadian law I've ever seen. It says, as has been known from Phoenician law, and then goes on to discussion of Phoenician law, whatever. Okay. I think what we're going to do, okay, this is what I'm going to do. We're going to, let's skip for a moment number two, because if we run out of time and don't do two, I don't think it's such a big deal. It was more ancillary of a sugya. It becomes more important later on, actually, in Chakir and in Arshai, which is why I put it all here. But let's skip to three and four, and then if we have time, we'll come back to two. So section three, new topic, right? One of the things we noted, right, is that the Gemara has a series of things, that it is that a series of cases where it is forbidden from the borrower to benefit the lender in any way. Now, this is very practical halachically, both because of the local issues, but also because of the comparisons, the sugya ayin hay, of ribbis dvarim. So the context of the Gemara on 64b, right, was if I lend money to somebody and he starts living in my property. So the Gemara says that's a problem. But the Gemara distinguishes between two cases. So they've just broken down the sugya as follows, right? The Gemara said the less problematic possibility is hilvehu velo hilveini. What is the difference? Hilvehu is where we didn't stipulate at the outset that because I'm lending you money, you'll be allowed to live in my apartment rent-free. You just did it, right? So that's less bad than if I said, lend me money, and then on condition that you live, I'm giving you that you can live in my property. That's hilveini. That's much more problematic because it was ktsitsa. So let's start with the less problematic. Hilvahu. So this is derabanan, right? It's avak ribis, or maybe even less, right? And that the Rishonim divide. And some Rishonim say it's straight avak ribis. Some say it's only mechzik ribis. The nafkamina would be whether latzis v'dei shamayim, you have to return it or not. But in court, you couldn't force it out. Then we have the following machlokas. Okay, assuming that it is avak ribis, which it is, by halvehu. So let's say I borrowed money and I let my the lender live in my property, but now I haven't yet paid back the loan. So if I already paid back the loan, so then obviously I can't force the money back from him. I can't force him to pay me the rent back, because that would be yotzei b'dayanim. But what happens if I haven't paid yet? Right? Can I deduct the rent on the property from what I pay back, or is that also considered yotze b'dayanim? So the Rif says, well, that's yotze b'dayanim, right? I mean, what does it mean when we say the ribis, which isn't d'oraita, which isn't ktsutza, isn't yotze b'dayanim, can't be forced by the court? It means that it isn't, it isn't legally significant in a human court. Who cares whether that means that I'm forcing him to pay me, or I'm withholding money that was supposed to go to him because of the loan? Bengach, it is aser. And therefore the Rif says, in a case of Hilvehu, where he just happened to live in my property, I can neither force him to pay it back to me once I paid back the loan, nor can I deduct the money from the payment of the loan. I have to pay back the loan, And that's it, right? He wants to pay it back to me. Lots of day shamayim, if it's avag rabbis, fine, but I can't force that on him. His proof is that the Gemara later on has a phrase that kol saluke belozuze afuke manahu. Anytime I force someone not to, right, I get rid of, you know, I send someone off without paying him, that's the equivalent of taking money from him. Rabbeinu Ephraim, on the other hand, says it's not true. Rabbeinu Ephraim says that's only by a mashkon. The case that the Rif is quoting is from a mashkon. It's true. If I force somebody off of a collateral that he currently has it in possession, that is a fukemona. I'm taking the collateral away from him. But in this case, I haven't paid him yet. So holding back from paying him is not the same as taking money away from him. That's the position of Rabbeinu Ephraim, and it's important because the Ramah actually paskens like Rabbeinu Ephraim. Okay, so that's for Halvehu. The even more problematic case was Halveni, where I actually tell you, give me, if you lend me money, I will let you live in my property. That's part of the original deal. That seems to be Ribbis Daraisa. And that is, in fact, the position of the Rif and the Rambam. Now, the Rif and the Rambam, the simplest understanding is that they believe this to be true, even if the property that I'm letting him live on is not a property that's normally rented out. And even if he's not somebody who normally rents property, even though in the normal rules of Dinei Mamonot, we say that if it's not a field that's normally rented, or the person doesn't normally rent, so he's not obligated to pay, in this case, the Meiri notes that the very fact that I stipulated that in return for the loan I will let you live in the property means that even if it, in general, this is not rentable property, I just made it rentable property because I gave it a monetary value. Namely, this is ribbis. This is the interest you're getting. This is the kickback you're getting for lending me the money. The Yad Havram says, even if it's not, maybe it's because of the Tovas Hanah, even though I don't normally rent this property, the fact that I have rights over it and I can kick you out of my property, I'm not, that is has monetary worth. And therefore, the Miri and the Yad Havram understand the Rif and the Rambam to say yes. In any case, it doesn't matter whether this is a field I normally rent out or not. If I stipulate that your interest on this loan is your ability to live in my property, that is always going to be ribbis d'oraisa. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says no. Interest, in order for it to be d'oraisa, can't just be stipulated. It needs to be that it was worth something monetarily irrespective of our current deal. And therefore, in order for it to be d'oraisa, it needs to be kai milagra. It needs to be property that in other circumstances is rentable and therefore worth money. And that's how he understands the Rif and the Rambam. But again, the simple understanding of the Rambam, and this is, the Beis Yosef understands this way as well, is that that's not true. Is that according to the Rif and the Rambam, Halveni, when I actually stipulate that this is a part of the deal, is going to be ribbis d'oraisa no matter what. A third issue that we saw within the Rishonim here is, okay, what about Halveni v'arvach le'zimne? What if I said Halveni, but not at the beginning of the loan, but at the end of the loan? I say, if you let me live in your property, then I'll let you hold on to the loan for another 3 weeks. Right? Is that ribbis d'oraisa? So almost all Rishonim say, of course it is. Right? Because of course it is, right? Like, what are you doing? You just stipulated it. The Rambam is unique. The Rambam says it's not true. The Rambam has a shita in two or three places in Hilchos Ribbis who says that no, arva, that in order for something to ribbis d'oraisa, not only does it need to be set, not only does it need to be stipulated, but it needs to be stipulated before the loan begins. Any other point is only d'rabbanan. Now, the truth is that there's really three positions we've shown him. The Rambam at one extreme, that in order for something to be ribbis d'oraisa, it must be stipulated at the beginning of the loan. Many other Rishonim, like the Ritva, who say no. Anytime I stipulate that this is interest, it doesn't matter, beginning of the loan, middle of the loan, end of the loan, doesn't matter, it's always d'oraisa. The Ravid is a middle position. The Ravid says no. It needs to be the beginning of a loan, but if the loan is over, and then you come back to me and say, can I extend the loan? And I say yes, if you give me interest, so he says that's essentially a new loan. And therefore, he says it's Right? He's a middle position. He fundamentally agrees with the Rambam that ribis d'oraisa is only when it's the beginning of a loan. He just thinks that arvach lazimne, the moment at which I grant you more time, is halachically a new loan, and therefore it's d'oraisa. So there's really three shitos in Rishonim, with the Ravid taking this middle position between the Rambam and the Ritva, for example.
Have you tried to square those with the philosophical things that you mentioned before, the Zucca, the Gezel, the whatever?
No. I could try, but I think it would be speculative. I mean, right, you could, right? What?
It would be speculative.
I mean, it would definitely be speculative. So I haven't tried. I haven't. I mean, I could hear arguments being made, but, you know, it would be a Rosenzweig share. The Nafkaminas could go in both directions. So, you know, he likes doing that, but, that was when I sometimes got lost. You know, if a Nafkamina could go in either direction, it's not a Nafkamina by definition, right? It's like, it doesn't come out of this because you could explain it according to both sides. Okay. Anyways, the second thing we noted in the sugya, besides for understanding the local sugya, is that in addition to understanding the local issues, the Rishonim try to figure out, okay, well, this sugya says that I lend somebody money, he can't live in my property. Later on, we find out that if I lend somebody money, I can't, whatever I can't do because of Ribbis Dvarim. I can't greet him in the morning. You know, we've had a bit of a discussion that maybe isn't just saying a good morning. It's presumably something more formal than that. But whatever exactly it is, and we'll have to really flesh out Ribbis Dvarim at some point. What? Ayin Hey, yeah. Meaning the last sugya, really. Or one of the last sugyas. But the fundamental question that we should deal with here is, okay, is it really always us? Is it really true that whenever I lend somebody money, so from now on, at least until the end of the loan, I cannot allow him to benefit from me at all? Like, that's sort of like what it sounds like in the sugya, but that can't be true. So the Rishonim, fundamentally, I cut out some of the intricacies of it, but basically have two main principles. One that they agree on is what's clearly emerges from the sugya is anything that I wouldn't have let you do or anything I wouldn't have given you before the loan, and I'm only giving it to you because you lent me money, that is usur, right? D'oraisa, they're abundant depending on the situation, that is always, always usur. That's for sure true. What happens if I would have done it for you before, but it's very public, and therefore, even though I would have done it for you before, it looks bad, right? So, for example, we're really close friends. This is the example I gave then. We're really close friends. I always let you use my timeshare. But now I borrowed money from you, right? And now it just looks bad. So here the Rishonim have a machlokas. Some of the Rishonim say that it's mutter. As long as I would have done it before, it doesn't matter. Public, private, the only question you have to ask is, would I have done it for you before? If yes, then I'm not doing it because of the loan. If no, then no. But others, and Tosfos in a few places, say no. If it's public, then even though it's not ribis, meaning I'm not giving to you because of the loan, it looks like I am, and therefore it's mechzik ribis, and therefore it's also anyways. But Rav Gestetner notes, and I think this is very important.
Who's Rav
Gestetner? Nathan Gestetner. He's a Lahoris Nasan. A very prominent posek who died a few years ago, I think, not so long
Where
ago.
Did he live?
What? Eretz Israel. Yeah, a prominent, you know, Israeli modern posek with excellent tshuvot. He knows what I think is has to be true here, which is it's true that there are many Rishonim who say that I can't allow you to benefit even in ways I let you benefit from my property before if I borrowed money from you. But 2009 he died? Right, like I knew he died after I already knew who he was, so it had to be after I was in yeshiva. So, like, you know, but he said, on the other hand, mechzi karibis can be solved in one of two ways: either that the benefit isn't public, or that the loan isn't public. He said, in the time of Chazal, it's clear that all loans were public information. Like, that's how Chazal talk about things. That's why anything that was a shtar, everybody knew about it. He said, realistically, nowadays, most people don't know about loans. So he said, if a loan is private, then that has the same effect of the benefit being private. And therefore, he says, practically, in order to make it usur, according to those Rishonim, you need two things. A, that the benefit is really public, And B, that the loan is public, and it's not often that you have those two factors together.
What about that it's public, but you have to look it up, for example?
No, he means public like people... No, public like people actually know about it, not like you could figure out. His point is...
No, I say like if you...
No, I understand. No, but that's his point, is that it's mechzi. This isn't a formal question. It's a substantive question. Will people look at this and look askance at it? If they have no idea, no one's looking up your loans... So he said, then you don't live in a society where mechzi is going to be as much of a problem, especially if it's something that, you know, you would have done before. There is a third question, which is, some Rishonim suggest, this is Machlokas, the Rosh Nagos Ashri, that even if I would have done it for you before, and it's private, which should normally be mutter, right? It's in private, and I would have done it for you before... If it actually costs me money, I'm not allowed to do it. So I'll bring just the halacha al-maisa question rather than the cases from the Rush and the Ashri. The following issue. What happened? This is Rav Gishtetner Shaila. We're really close friends. I always lend you my car. And we're such close friends that I don't make you fill up the gas tank. Like, I lend, you know, you borrow my car, I borrow your car, big deal. We don't care. Right? And now... I happen to borrow money from you. So normally would say, look, I never made you pay the gas before, and let's say lending a car is private, or people don't know about the loan. So either way, so it should be mutter. So he said, so you would say, okay, so I also don't have to make you fill up the gas. But he said, that's not obvious, because the Rush thinks that when we're in a borrower-lender relationship, even if I would have done it for you before, even if it's private, it doesn't matter. You can't allow me to lose money, right? To actually have a lose money and not make you pay for it. Because once we're in a lender-borrower relationship, right, I borrowed $1,000 and I let you use $100 of gas without paying me back, that looks very much like interest. And the Rush says that even though last week when you didn't lend me the money, I let you use up the gas tank, it doesn't matter. If there's an actual loss, then you're not allowed to do it. The Hagos Ashri says no, even that case is mutter, because you would have done it before. And the Shulchan Aruch Harav agrees with the Hagos Ashri, so Shtetner notes that with the gas, he's not totally convinced. Right? He's not convinced that you would be allowed to let the person just use the gas without making him pay. One of the other implications that the post can really bring up, I already mentioned the cars and gas issue, is aliyot. Right? Can you give somebody an aliyah? That's the Marshal's case. So on the one hand, it's very public, right? On the other hand, the loan might not be public, as Grishketner notes, but the Marshal really says, and Magen Avraham Paskin is this way, that a gabbai, at least if the loan is known, can't give aliyot to somebody. Now, he's assuming that this is true, even if you would have done it before, because he's assuming, like, that other position in Tosas, that anything public is automatically also because it looks wrong. Lemaisa, you might have to distinguish. Let's say someone did know about the gabbai's loan. I think it would depend, on whether the shul has a policy, right? Like, if the shul has a policy that anyone who has a yard site in the week gets an aliyah, so then everybody understands that the reason the guy's getting aliyah is because he has a yard site. Like, he gets up, they say mishabeirach for the neshama. Like, everyone understands the gabbai isn't giving him an aliyah because he borrowed money from him. If it's, you know, a stam aliyah on a, you know, he doesn't have it, he just needs a, you know, to give somebody aliyah, he gives it to you, and everybody knows about the loan. So yeah, according to Balei Tosfot, it would presumably be usur because it's very public, and that's the position of the Magen Avraham. But Lemaisa, as Rav Gishtetner notes, how often does this come up? How often do you know what loans the gabbai has taken up, and you're paying attention to, like, the gabbai who he called up for an aliyah and who he lent money to? It would have to be a case where that would be true. If it happened, then sure, it would be usur. The last thing that the postman brought up there is you also can't borrow money from someone who you've hired if you talked about it in the deal, right? Like, because you might think that the fact that you hired him is kickback for the loan. The Marami Rutenberg actually seems to think this is d'oraisa, but most Rishonim say no, it's not d'oraisa, because at the end of the day, you hire him. He's getting paid because he's doing a job. The fact that you hired him, it has monetary value, but you're still paying him for his job, not for the loan. So most Rishonim assume that it is Usr, and the Ramah Paskins this way, and Shulchan Aruch Paskins this way, but it's only the Rabbanan. The Rambam himself says it's the Oraisa. Okay, the next very mini issue here, which is actually an issue which we never... Yeah.
So let's say Kurbis, is that a distinct legal principle, or is it just a subsection of Maris Ayin or Chashad?
It seems to be that some of it is just Maris Ayin and some of it is unique to Ribis. Like when you look at the postkim, some of them come up with sort of unique Mechlik Ribis cases, and sometimes they're just talking Maris Ayin. And that's my feeling, right? That you find both. Mm-hmm. No? I think so.
Yeah.
It seems like it. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Hi. If you stipulated in advance, yeah.
But in that case, let's say you have a big property, if it's then and it's a lot there,
so that's the Ramban, right? The Ramban says that you're right. If it's a case then it's a lot, it's only the Rabbanan, even if you stipulate it. But the Rif and the Rambam, Miri, say no, that's fine. But if you stipulated it, it's true, you didn't lose anything. But once you make it part of the loan, right, you're making it clear that you're granting it value by doing that.
Isn't that still Rabbanan?
Well, so that's the Ramban's argument. The Ramban's argument is the Rabbanan. The Meiri, the Rambam, the Rif seemingly say, no, that's the Oraisa. Once you stipulate it, right, if you didn't stipulate, it's not the Oraisa. But if you stipulate it, then even though you're right, in theory you don't care, but the fact that you said, you talked about it, means you care enough that it's worth money in the context of this deal. And that's really the position of the Rambam, right?
So,
again, that's the Ramban's argument, right? The Ramban's argument is that it needs to be objective, right? It needs to be that this is rentable property, and therefore that I objectively, there was money that transferred hands. But the Rif and the Rambam don't believe that. They say, no, this is called Neshach already, right? Once you stipulate it, you've granted it subjective value. And now you are giving him subjective value, right? You've quantified it, right? You know, it's no worse than saying, right, I didn't have to charge you, but you know, now I'm charging you, and you're giving me the right. But I didn't have to put in monetary value, but now I am, and I'm not charging it. You know, that's what you're doing, right? Is you didn't have to, but you did. Correct, and that's what he's saying is that once I've said that this is something I could charge for, and I want to in this context, and I'm going to waive the payment, right? I'm waiving the $100 that I actually could have at this point taken from you because you've agreed to treat this as monetarily valuable. Right, that's really what Miri's saying, and you know, within the Rambam, is that right? You're saying at this point that I could, if it weren't for the loan, I am now defining this as rentable property, and I'm not taking the money that I should be able to take from you because of the loan. That's already considered enough of a, you know, loss from the Lova and a gain to the Malva. Right. Again, that's what you're just channeling the Ramban. The Ramban says, I don't get it. Either it's objective. Right, it's an objective monetary loss. You can't create subjective monetary loss. Miri says yes, you can. Right, you say that it's lost subjectively. I put here. This was a sugya that we actually had started and never got back to. So I got back to it right here in four very quickly. Is the Gemara has a machlokas about ribis amanas lahachzir. The case that the Gemara brings up is where you sell property and you say that when you finish paying it up, so then this will be a sale. But if not, you're going to have to return it. So if you eat fruit from the property now, so if he ends up paying it, so retroactively he bought the field and he was eating fruit from his own field. If, on the other hand, he never manages to get the money together to pay the field, he'll have to return the field. So the fact that you were eating fruit on it in the meantime while it's ribis because you were just holding on to the money, right? You're going to return the money, he's going to return the field. So there was ribis because you were now eating fruit because he was holding on to your money and you were holding on to his field. It's ribis. But you're planning on giving the money back. Like if you do eat the peiros, you do eat the fruit, you'll return the peiros. So the Gemara is a machlokas whether that's osir. So the Gemara in one stage says maybe the machlokas is whether ribis amanas lahachzir is osir. So the Rishonim say, well, why would it be usher to have ribis almanas lahachzir? Like you're giving the money back, right? There's no neshech, right? You're giving the money back, right? Like there's, why should that be de'oraisa? So here, Tosfos, and this is what we had seen, say, well, you're not returning it until the end, right? I mean, what's the deal that you have a year to come up with the money for your field, right? If you don't come up with it, so then it's a full, you know, so then the sale goes through, right? But that means at least for a year, right, I have, you're holding on to my money, I have the right to eat a fruit. I would pay money to have the right to eat fruit for a year and not have to go to the store, right? Even if at the end of the year I have to pay you back the money for all the fruit that I ate. The fact is that I get a year worth of time where I don't have to go shopping, right? I have all the fruit right here. That has monetary worth. And that's why it's usher, because yes, I'm paying back the money at the end, but I gain the convenience of having this fruit here for a year. What? Yeah, you know, the fact that I have to pay back, it's like having a tab. That's all it is, right? You're giving me, right, the rights to have this tab and get all the fruit. That's valuable. The Chavos Das has a more practical problem. He says, it's true, you're giving back the money. But when you give back the money, the value may not be the same, right? What are you going to do? You're going to give back the value of fruit, but maybe I got a discount, right? Because, you know, maybe the fruit will, you know, the price goes down, the price goes up. It's just because I give back the money, you can't necessarily give back all the money. Because whenever it's going to take a long time, I may have actually gotten value from this fruit that is not returnable or not quantifiable or not something I could figure out. The Chavos Das says that's why Riz Doraisa is a problem. Riz Saman of the Hachzer is a problem Doraisa. The Ritva says, no, the deal wasn't actually that I bought the property and, you know, if you don't give, you know, if you get the money together, then I have to give it back to you. No, I made a following deal. I bought the property from you 100%. But I make a deal with you. You have a year. If you get the money together, I will sell it back to you. So it's actually not a loan at all, right? I actually bought the property. I just am a nice guy, and I made a deal with you that you're allowed to buy it back within a year. I'll give it to you. The Ritva says, even so, it's usur. Why? Because no one makes a deal like that. Right? Even though you made a deal like that, it doesn't count because no normal person makes a deal like that. And he says, ribbit is substantive. We don't say, was this technically a mecher or a loan? He says, I asked the question, is this a normal sale or does it look like a loan? If it looks like a loan, it is a loan. I don't care if it's formally not a loan. It is a loan for the purposes of ribbit. And therefore, the very fact that I'm letting you eat the peros in this context, right, that he says is ribbis, and then I note that there's a machlokas and the achronim whether the reason ribbis amanaz lahachzir is usur is as a subset of ribbis, or because ribbis is really gezel, and gezel is also usur amanaz lahachzir. That's a sugya also in this perek, the one that we skipped over, but a sugya also, which is gonev amanaz lemekat, which is also usur. The only thing I noted there is that even though gezel manas lahachzir is usur, there is a machlokas in the achronim whether it's gzela at the same level that everything else is, which has nafkaminas for like chiyuv onsen and the like, and would have the same implications here. Like even if it is, you know, gezel, right? Okay, but I ate it in the end of the day with permission. What happens if through an unavoidable accident something gets destroyed? Am I liable? So that is a machlokas in the poskim. Okay, we have 3 minutes, I guess, to do two.
Well,
maybe not.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chavos Das Doraisa is within Tosos, right? He's saying, he's offering an alternative to Tosos. The Gemara assumes Doraisa. Everyone really assumes Doraisa.
So, isn't the Chavos Das like conceptually the same as Sabasa?
Yeah, that's exactly what he says. He said the problem of Rabbi Samas Lachzer is the same as Sabasa, but on a Doraisa level. Right? Because Sabasa, you know, is Darabana, and this he thinks is Doraisa. Why exactly you distinguish? You know.
That was
my
question. Okay.
Right. I mean, the thing by Sabasa, yeah, you have to give it some thought of why exactly we distinguish. Okay, we have 3 minutes. I'll just, you know, put it out here. Section two, we dealt with a very specific Haramas Ribis case, which is summarized in Shulchan Aruch, right, which is, if you say, Halveni mana, Amar alei mana, in li chitim mana, yeshli, menazim lo chitim mana, right, it's a case where I say, borrow, you know, lend me money, I say, I don't have money, but here's the deal that I'll make, right, is I will sell you chitim for 100, and then I'll buy them back for you for 90, right, for 90, but I'll still owe you the 100 at the end of the day, right? So that's usur, right, that's usur.
You still owe me the 100.
You'll still owe me the 100, right? You'll still owe me the 100, but I'll buy it for 90, right? So I'm essentially getting 10 benefit here. As Shulchan Aruch notes, if we actually stipulated everything that I just said is d'oraisa, right? Because that's straight up ribbis. If we didn't stipulate, it's just what happens. So then it's only d'rabbanan, right? That's haramas ribbis. And the achronim note I gave you in the just the summary here. The Taz says even the d'rabbanan is only usher if you do the two transactions at the same time, right? Meaning, in the same moment, when I borrow the money, I buy it back from you. If I wait 2 weeks, so it's not even haramas ribbis, because look, I could have sold it to somebody else in the meantime. I happen to come back to you, but who cares? The Shach says this is only in a case of a sale, but by an actual loan, this wouldn't work. The Talmidei HaRashba say that it's clearly mutter if the price goes down, right? Like, I wait 2 weeks, and then the price actually goes down to 90, and that's why I sell to you. Okay, fine, so then it's mutter. Like, I'm not giving you the discount because of the loan. I'm giving you because the price went down. That's fine. The Rambam says this isn't even abak ribbis. The Ramban says it is. And again, as we've noted, the difference between saying something is abak ribbis or not even abak ribbis is whether lotzis b'dei shamayim, you have to return it. This becomes important. That's what I gave you in the two pieces. You can look at inside from Shulchan Aruch. Kostav dal kufayin dalet is a sugya we haven't seen yet, called Chakirei Narshai, which is basically this case, except with a mashkon, right? Where, as you just look at Shulchan Aruch, Misha Haisa Sada Mumushkenet Biyado, Lo Yachtav Yaskar Salabala Sada, where I rent out the collateral property back to the person who borrowed the money, right? That's Chakirei Narshai. This sugya of Haramas Ribis is the basis of the sugya of Chakirei Narshai, under what circumstances is mutter, what is usur. So we don't have time to get into it, but the reason I just remind ourselves of this sugya is because even though it's sort of ancillary, it sets the groundwork for a sugya that we will have to get to when we actually deal with Mashkon in Elul at some point. So just keep that in mind when we get there, but we'll come back to these issues then. Shkoyach.